Hi, everybody. My name's Diana, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm already so emotional here. This is a wonderful place. I mean, everybody here has been so kind and so warm. So many snacks, so much coffee. I've had people that just walk up and help me with things. And I just feel moved by this place. And I'm so, so glad that I was invited to come. I was a barroom drinker. Any other barroom drinkers in here? How about you, Anna? Drinking in the barrooms. That's what I loved. I was drinking in the barrooms every day. I wasn't even old enough to drink yet. Well, you know, the ID and all. I had one of my brother's IDs I used to show when I had to. And, you know, I loved it. I'd get on that bar stool, and I'd feel at ease. I'd feel all right. And I didn't feel at ease anyplace else. I didn't feel at ease in my own home, in my own bed, with my own family, who loved me. I didn't feel at ease. But I get on that bar stool, and I get a couple of drinks in me, and I felt on top of the world, $1 million. I felt taller and smarter and prettier and bulletproof and comfortable. And, you know, I was a functional alcoholic for about 3 weeks, I figure. As I look back on it now. And, you know, very quickly, nothing mattered to me more than that bar stool. And I got a job so that I could pay for my drinks. And my first job was my first real job. I worked in a nursing home. And I worked with this nurse, and I'd work the second shift. I went to high school, and then I'd go to work, second shift with her, and at the end of the shift, she'd take me to the bar room with her. I loved her. Oh, God. I'd follow her anywhere. I did anything she said at work, because I knew at the end of the shift, she's taking me with her. And if she worked an extra shift, I'd work the extra shift. She was a nice lady, but she liked to drink, and so did I. So I thought this was great. To me, this was great. And I dragged myself to high school every day, you know, do what I had to do to get through that. And I did eventually graduate from high school. And then my drinking could be more hours per day. And that I was happy about, too. I had a little scholarship. I used to say I had a scholarship. I can't say that because I have now remembered, because you do, that it was financial aid. It wasn't a scholarship at all. It was financial aid. I had 6 brothers and sisters. You know, yeah, financial aid. And it was the community college. And I was going there. And, you know, I couldn't get there. I was carpooling with a couple of guys up in Massachusetts. And I'd say, oh, my goodness, look at that, Allen's Pub, right on the way to the school. I said, I don't have a class right now, you know, 8:30 a.m. So drop me off here, and I'll meet you up at the school. And they were like, are you sure? You know, I was never more certain of anything in my life. I'm sure. You know, needless to say, I didn't get to the school very often. I didn't finish the first semester on that financial aid. And then I just stopped going with them. It was easier to drink next door to my house. I didn't have to worry about a ride home so much. You know what? We got a triangle in here. I love the triangle. And I ended up a triangle out there. I had the bar room I drank in, the diner I worked in, and the apartment I slept in. Now it was my triangle. And it was pretty organized. It was walkable. And I thought, well, what do I need this car for? Back then, we called them gas hogs. You know, the big eight-cylinder Pontiac Le Mans or some crazy thing I was driving around. And this car constantly wants my money. It's got to have gas all the time. It eats more than I do. And the tires and the oil and the insurance and driver's license, it's all money that I could be putting to better use. So I took the car up in the woods and left it there. And, you know, it was a big relief. Whew. No more stress off of that car. You know, it's sad, though. That's how I walked away from everything. Whew. No more school. And then I'd walk away from jobs. No more jobs. And my family, I walked away from my family. You know, it's too much pressure. I just wanted to sit on that bar stool. I just called my name. I couldn't go by there. I say, I'm going to miss something, you know. I had to be in there. And I drank with a couple of old guys, Eddie and Louie. And they drink all day long. I drink with them. And they were, and we'd watch reruns of Hogan's Heroes and Vanna White turning the letters. And I thought, this is plenty enough education for anybody. I don't have to go anywhere but right here. I was happy there. And I'd work in the diner just enough to get enough money to drink for that day. I was living a day at a time, really. I thought everything was okay if it could just stay that way. And one day, Eddie had a girlfriend that would come in and once a month and beat the hell out of him, get a check off. He had this check he used to get, I guess. We never saw it. She'd come get it off of him. And we'd just stand back. She's coming! She'd get that check off. We didn't even... And then we'd pick him up and dust him off and put him back. And Louie had a beagle he kept out in the car. And I'd run a Slim Jim out every once in a while, keep the dog alive for him. And they were my friends. They were my confidants. That's where I felt okay, was on that bar stool with them guys. I felt safe there. I felt okay. I didn't feel that way anywhere else. And one day, Eddie come out of a blackout. He says, what are you doing here with us all the time? You're young. You have your whole life in front of you. And I was crushed. When he said that to me, I was crushed. I thought, I don't belong anywhere. This is my only place. And I didn't want to be rejected by them. So that went on. I thought everything was fine. And of course my family worried. But one day, as so often happens to us in here, you know, Mr. Wright comes walking in that bar room. And I knew he was Mr. Wright because he had a job. And he had a car. And he liked to drink. And he liked me. And I thought, well, this is it then. So the next day, we were a couple. And, I guess we call it dating in here. But, you know, we just were the two left over at the end of the night that nobody else wanted. And so we were a couple. And we went on, you know you're in here. There's a lot of couples in here. That's how you got together. know it. So, hey, sometimes it works out great. So him and I, you know, we went on, we drank. We had some fun, you know. We really did. And he wasn't a bad guy. He really wasn't a bad guy. And I wasn't a bad girl. We were just drunks. We were just drunks. And it doesn't get better for people like us out there. It doesn't. And it didn't for us. And what happened to us was I turned up pregnant. You know, that's what you say in my family. She turned up pregnant. It was like, you know, you just turned up that way like a, you know, like toast coming out of the toaster. I mean, you just turned up pregnant, like, you know, and you don't really know what happened, but you did. You don't remember anything. And there you are. And I said, geez, I don't know what to do. And he did. He said, well, what we got to do is we got to get married, got to have a family, we're going to change our lives. He says, he had a good job, actually. And he says, they're going to send me to Denmark to work. We're going to go there. We're going to be different. And we both believed it. We both believed it. You know. And you want to believe it. And when you say it, you mean it. I meant it every time I said, I'm not going to drink again. I'm going to be different. I meant it. And the sad, heartbreaking part of it is it's impossible. We got to have this program. We can't do it out there alone. But I didn't know that. I didn't know much. I knew I was going to get on that plane with this man and go to some foreign country and have a baby. I was scared to death. You know, and the whole way over there, we're drinking on the plane, making plans how we're not going to drink anymore. Because, you know, that's the best time to plan how to stop is when you're happen the rapper. You know. So we get over there. And, you know, by then I wasn't able to hold a job anyways. I had become unemployable already. But we get over there and he goes to work. And I go to the bar room. I mean, it's as natural to me as brushing my teeth. I go to the bar room, and I start drinking in the bar rooms over there with Eddie and Louie. I found a nice dark hole in the wall with an Eddie and Louie in there, and they didn't even speak English. And it didn't matter. They spoke my language. We sit here, we drink. I taught them how to swear in English. They taught me how to swear in Danish. I took them to see the movie Scarface. I said, this is how we live in America. I scared the hell out of them. These old Danes. And you know, I knew, this is when the horrors of alcoholism started to set in for me. This is when the loneliness and the self-loathing, because I knew that I shouldn't be drinking. I knew it was wrong. I knew I was a terrible person. I knew that I should not be going to this bar room. And I was wearing big baggy clothes trying to conceal that pregnancy, to hide it. I knew I didn't belong in a bar room, but I didn't belong anywhere else. And that's when I started to cry about my drinking. And one day in that bar room, those guys realized, you know, it's hard to conceal it after a while, that I was pregnant. And they cast me out of there. They threw me out of that bar room. I mean, even drunks don't want a pregnant drunk around. They don't, you know. the shame involved for us women who go through that. It's so lonely, because even the drunks don't want us around. See, and we know that. And they called me names, and I agreed with them. I knew they were right. I was bad. I was horrible. They were right. And I had no solution. And I went home from the barroom, you know, determined I'm never going to drink again. I'd been saying it for months. But what I did was I got a jug of wine, went down in the cellar by myself, drank, crying. What's the matter with me? I'm the worst person on the earth. I'm just lower than low. I'm going to hurt this baby. I know I'm hurting this baby. This is wrong. Crying. I'm not going to do it tomorrow. I'm not going to do it tomorrow. I just couldn't stop. Still makes me weep. How lost I was, and how much pain I was in, and how so many of us end up in a place just like that for different reasons. These lonely, cold places in our hearts where we don't think we're worth anything. Sad what happens to us. And I didn't believe in God at that time. I'd become an atheist. I had become sure there was no God. I was certain of it. And what happened was I started to have the pains of labor. If you've heard about this, yeah, or if you've experienced it. It's quite terrifying. And we went to the hospital like you do. And now what I was most terrified of was that the baby was going to have all kinds of problems. And those problems were all my fault. And everybody was going to know that. And I was going to burn in hell. Because I did believe in hell. And so I went to the hospital, locked myself in the bathroom in this hospital in Copenhagen, Denmark, and I said, I'm not coming out. And I wasn't going to. And I would still be there today if it were possible. But what happens is, oh, you are not doing that. It starts hurting. I come running out of there. Help! Help! Do something! Oh, and they did. You know, they did. I was useless, you know. I didn't even know what to do. And they did. And they birthed this baby. This beautiful baby. And they handed him to me. And his eyes were open. And I looked into his eyes. And I saw God. For the very first time, I saw God. And I'm not saying that God wasn't there before that moment. I'm just telling you, I never recognized him before that moment. And I looked into those eyes. Perfect love is what I experienced in those eyes. Perfect love. And I fell in love. I fell in love with that baby. And I was more determined than ever. I will never drink again. I will be the best mom. I love this child. I'll do everything right. He won't want for anything. And I meant it more than I'd ever meant it before in my life. I meant it. And we went home from the hospital. And he went to work. And I went down in the cellar with a jug of wine. And the newborn. And the horrors of alcoholism multiplied. I did not understand what was wrong with me. I had no idea that I suffered from this illness. And I had no idea there was anything I could do about it. And I continued to drink, and I continued to hate myself. And we came back to the States, and I went back to the bar rooms. And now I was finding babysitters and excuses. And I had people didn't want to drink with me anymore. That happened to any of you folks? people don't want to drink with you when you drink like I did. But I had this one friend. She would still drink with me, her and I. And I started to go to a psychiatrist. My son's father, my husband at the time, he insisted that I go to a psychiatrist. He was sure something was wrong with me too. So I went to the psychiatrist. And I got diagnosed with a Valium deficiency. That was the best diagnosis I ever had. I liked it. And they give you some pills to take to make up for the deficiency. And they tell you don't drink on it. Of course, you go right away and drink on it. You're hoping, you're going, what? I wonder what's going to happen. You're all excited. Mix it up a little. And turns out my friend, she had the same problem and the same pills. So her and I would sit in the bar rooms and take these pills and drink. And we were the calmest drunks going. We were so relaxed. We were like Gumby walking around. We didn't bother anybody. So one night I look, she would carry these big pocketbooks, these big, huge pocketbooks, all kinds of stuff in there. You could live for a week out of it. But I said, geez, I notice you carry a blow dryer around in your purse. You got a hair dryer in there. What do you do that for? She says, well, I find when I pee my pants, it's easier. I just go in the ladies' room and dry it all up. And I thought, oh, my God, I am so glad I am not that bad. Until I peed my pants. And then I thought, she's a genius. Because what are you going to do? Absolute genius. So glad she's my friend. It wasn't glamorous, obviously, though I thought I was fine. The sad part was I knew I wasn't. I missed my child. I had people ask me all the time, you got a husband and a baby at home, what are you doing out here? And I'd feel so bad, so dirty, and so terrible. I didn't know what I was doing out there. I had to have a drink. So I became convinced that it was the marriage was the reason I was drinking. It was his fault. I was sure of it. Absolutely positive. I could have took a lie detector test and passed. It was his fault. And if I could just leave him, I would be okay. And so I did. I left the marital home. I took a coffee pot. I took a laundry basket full of clothes. I took the baby from his father. And I took a car that had a loan on it. And I drove off. And I remember thinking, everything's going to be okay now, because I got rid of the problem. I didn't know the problem was right here. I had no idea. Got a little apartment, got a little job. And I was shocked to find myself drunk repeatedly. And he wasn't there for me to blame. I was shocked. How could this be possible? So I got a little job. I said, well, I'm waiting on these tables. I'm doing a lot of waitressing work. That's a good job for a drunk. So I better get a job with a desk. If I have a desk, I won't drink. People with desks don't drink. So I went around that town lying to everybody about all these credentials I had. And I got a job with a desk. And it had a computer and a phone, neither of which I had ever operated. The phone with all the buttons. And I lied and said I knew how to do all that. And so I was sitting in this room with these other ladies, and I'm pretending to do this job. And I'm watching the button. They're pushing buttons. I'm pushing buttons. They're saying stuff on the phone. I'm saying whatever they're saying. And I'm going in the bathroom to drink. I'm leaving at lunch, and lunch. What do they give you lunch for on those jobs? I said, what are they giving us lunch for? It's torture. I go to lunch, and you want me to come back? I can't. Just don't let me go. I can't come back from lunch. That's impossible. So, trying to do this job. My sponsor's here. I love her so much. Barbara. So, doing this job, I'm doing the best I can with it. Except I'm not really doing it because I don't know how to do it. I'm just pretending I'm doing it. Now, I had been fired from my previous two jobs for the way I smelled. Call me in the, you know, they call you in the back room. Well, I smelled. And they don't want you serving food when you smell, you know, like bourbon and whatever else. So I got called into the back room on this job. And I thought, well, maybe he's going to make a pass, you know, the boss. And I'll have a new boyfriend, you know. Or a promotion. Maybe I'm going to get a promotion probably. Because I'm pretty good at this job. Right? I was delusional. So he calls me in the back room. I go back there, hoping he's going to make a pass. And he says, you see this big computer back here? Oh, big computer. Yeah, I see. Yeah. I said, I can handle it. I'd never even seen a computer in my life. And he says, well, this computer monitors all the calls that we get in here, and you haven't been getting any. So who have you been talking to on the phone? Because I was only pretending to have customers. I was never going to talk to a real customer on that phone. So I'm caught. Now, I got caught all the time. I wasn't a good criminal, never. I got caught everything I ever did. And what I would say is I had a standard line. Let me just get my purse. Just let me get my purse. I'm out of here. I won't bother you anymore. I was not a fighter. I gotta go. I'll go. And he says, no, no, no. And he he proceeded to tell me his story like I'm telling you mine tonight. He told me that he had 2 years without a drink or a drug, that he had broken home, broken family, 3 children he couldn't see unless he was supervised by the state of Massachusetts. He told me that he used to drink and break the furniture and fight. Barroom drinker. Now I'm looking at this guy. He's my boss. He's got on a polo shirt and a pair of chinos. I'm thinking, he don't look like he does what I do. But he's telling me, I was so confused. And no one had ever been that honest with me before. And that, I just didn't know. So I thought he wanted my advice. I thought he was kind of confessing. He was making a confession, and he wanted me to hear it. And so I willingly gave him my advice. And I said, I'm glad you shared that with me, because I'm not the type to tell anybody else. And you don't ever have to tell anybody again. You got it off your chest. And I'm thinking, we're friends now, and I don't even have to come back from lunch. And he says, do you know you have 2 different shoes on today? I did not know that. And I to this day don't know how long I had been wearing that particular non-pair. And I thought, let me just get my purse. I don't know what this guy wants. And what he said to me was, if you ever think that you might have a problem with alcohol, I know some people. They helped me, and I think they could help you too. He never said who they were. He never said it was you. I didn't know what he was. I thought I was going to be fired. He said, no, you're not fired, but I'm going to teach you how to use that computer and the phone so that you can do your job. And he didn't throw me out. I had been thrown out many times, and he didn't. See? And I don't know what moved me more in the days that followed. The fact that he didn't throw me out, or the story that he told me. Maybe probably both things. Both things moved me. And a few weeks later, I crawled into work on a Tuesday, you know, because I couldn't make it on Monday. And I went to him. His name was Joe. And I said, Joe, will you take me to your people? I'm exhausted. And I didn't know who his people were. I didn't know if they were Yankee fans. And I was still willing to go. I didn't know who they were. Martians? I didn't care who they were. I was so tired. I was so tired of me. I was tired of breaking the hearts of the people around me. I had an eviction notice on the apartment door that I lived in with my little boy. I was hiding the car from the repossession people, trying to figure out how I was going to live in it with my little boy. I didn't have any electricity on in that apartment, and barely any food. And I could no longer look at my child in his eyes. I was too ashamed of the person I had become, and that I owed him something. And I loved him so much, and I couldn't back it up. So tired. So I said, "Joe, will you take me to your people?" And he said, "Well, I live in the other direction, so I can't take you, but I'm going to write it down where you're going to go." And he called somebody, and I know now he called the central office out in my neighborhood, and he wrote down the meeting. And he gave it to me on a piece of paper. And he said, "Don't drink the rest of the day. Can you don't drink the rest of the day and go to this meeting tonight?" And I said, "I will. I will do it." And I went and I looked at the paper. And the paper said, was at a church. It was an address of a church. And I lost hope. Because I thought, they're not going to let me in a church. They're never going to let me in there. I'm so bad. But he wrote Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, well, it's anonymous. I'm going to wear a disguise. They won't know it's me. This all made sense to me that day, really. And I went home and I put on a big straw hat with a big red bow on it, big Jackie O glasses, sunglasses, and my best Salvation Army dress. A pair of shoes that matched. Actually matched. I'm so paranoid of that now. Still paranoid of that. I could have worn those for a year. I don't know. And I went to that. I drove over to that meeting. In my unregistered, uninsured, barely any gasoline, all dented up Buick Skyhawk that I was planning on living in with my little boy, who was now 2 years old. He was 2 years old. And I was out in that parking lot at that meeting that night, and I'm looking around. And these people are not in disguise. I'm like, how come no one else is in a disguise? It says anonymous. It's anonymous. And I'm smoking 50 cigarettes. You know, you can always buy those. You don't care. No food, doesn't matter. No electric. You're going to have cigarettes. And I thought, you know, I was scared. Am I really going to go in this place? Me? Walk in a church? And I thought, well, no matter what happens to me in there, it can't be any worse than what's happening to me out here. I don't know where that thought came from. You know, it didn't come from me. I don't have that kind of courage. But it came to me, and all the courage I had in the world, I marched up into that meeting. I marched up into that church basement and into my whole new life. I had no idea what was in store for me. None whatsoever. I went up into that meeting. I sat in the back. I said, these people, they look pretty put together. I don't know. They don't drink where I drink. You know, they all had teeth. I'm like, they don't have teeth where I drink. You know, that's a commodity. We don't have those where I drink. And we don't have eyes either. They all had eyes. I'm there, oh my God. They don't, I don't think they really understand what I'm going through, the way I drink. And I didn't really hear too much. I heard the guy next to me, he says, "You want a cup of coffee?" And I'm there, I'm thinking I'm invisible in my disguise. How's he talking to me? He can't talk to me. You know how you feel, you're crawling out of your skin. You think nobody can notice you. It's so obvious. So, I saw a guy walk up to the coffee pot at the break. And I recognized him from the bar room. And I said, "I used to drink with that. I'm sure that's him, but he looks so different. He had eyes and teeth." I'm there, what in the heck happened to him? I used to throw up next to him in the bar. I don't get it. And I went up to him after the meeting. His name was Peter. He's still sober today. We're still friends. I said, "Peter, what's going on here?" I demanded to know. And he goes, "Who are you?" So I lifted my disguise briefly, you know. "Peter, it's me, Diana." He says, "We've been waiting for you." "You have?" He says, "We have." I was like, "Phil, you have? Oh, are the cops here?" Then I got paranoid. "Are the cops here? Why are you waiting?" And then what he did was, he stood back and he started to talk to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "This is where we go on Tuesday nights. That's Irish Pat. That's Zeus over there. That's Mary. She'd make a good sponsor." He starts this, and I'm there. And then he goes, "Tomorrow night, we go over to such and such." He goes, "I'll pick you up and bring you there." He says, "This is what we do." And I was in the "we." He was already in the "this is what we do." Right? "This is what we do." He already had me. "This is where we go." He says, "How you feeling?" I said, "Not too good, Pete." He says, "You don't ever have to feel like that again." He says, "Come along with us. Come along with us." And in his eyes, I saw that perfect love that I had seen in my newborn baby's eyes. He had it too. Perfect love coming out of his eyes. And I thought, something's going on here. I don't know what this is, but I'm damn sure going to show up tomorrow night. Because this could be a date. Could be. I'm not sure yet, but he's picking me up. You know, there's always that. So, I just was blown away. What's in the eyes of these people? And you see, I see God. I didn't call it God back then. I didn't know what it was. I call it, I know that's what it is now. I know that. I see it in your eyes in here tonight. I see it in all your eyes. I hope you see it in mine. Those are they say the windows to the soul. They call it all kinds of things. But I say on page 55 in our big book, my beloved, beloved Alcoholics Anonymous, on page 55, it says, "Within every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God." And that's what I see in your eyes. And that was what I've seen all throughout my years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked everywhere else too. I still look everywhere else, but that's where I find it. Spiritual seeker. My friend that I drank with the Valium, I went to her funeral. She was my first 12-step call, she called. I said, I'll be right over. I'm bombing over there. She got a jug of gin on the kitchen table. She had two little boys that she couldn't take care of. I had the one. And I said, you got to come to the AA. Like, I've been doing this work. So I had about, I don't know, 2-3 months. I wanted to help her so bad. And then, but she's half in the bag already. And then that gin started to smell good to me. So I went over to the phone. I called Peter. I said, Peter, I don't know what to do. He said, what are you doing over there by yourself? He come right over. We never do this alone. He says, never. They'll get you drunk before you ever get them sober. And we took her to the detox. We called her mother to come and get the little boys. And we prayed for her. And a couple years later, I went to her funeral. She died of alcoholism. And her mother was telling everyone that she died of asbestosis because she couldn't bring herself to tell the truth about what really happened to her. And I sat there and listened to her two little boys cry for their mother. And that kept me sober that day, I'll tell you. That's what happens to us. That's the reality. And what happens to us is that we come in here and we allow the people in here see God's love popping out of their eyes all over us. We heal. We heal from this and we recover. We live. My life, I can't even believe it's my life. What time is it? Have I got time to tell you? What does that mean? I thought you were saying, get off of this stage. Get off of here. Fly away. You'll give me the heads up. Lee knows me. He'll give me the heads up. So my life, what happened to my life? Oh, my gosh. Let me tell you about Ernie and Edith. Let me tell you about Martha. Martha was my sponsor, my first sponsor for 17 years. And she passed away. But she was, I don't know how she really put up with me. I don't know how the groups put up with me. I become the copy maker of my group, so now I've got all the authority, I figure. And I'm going to run the place the right way. Now I have 8 months of sobriety. I'm in charge. And I'm making the copy. I had my ex-husband then. Must have been a couple years down the road because we did get divorced. And then he turns up at the AA meeting, at my group. Well, what are you doing in my group? There's another group down the street. My group. I'm the coffee maker here. Take a hike. And they let him in. They let him in. I'm there. You're letting in. Do you know who you're letting in? So I call an ad hoc emergency business meeting to settle the matter. He can't come here. And they, you know, politely and very lovingly and patiently put up with me and told me he most certainly could come there. So now I'm monitoring his every move. And I'm calling my sponsor from the phone in the kitchen. They had him on the wall back then, on the kitchen, calling her up. Martha, he's doing this, he's doing that. She says, you better find another group. Stay in the back, make the kitchen, mind your own business, make the coffee. So I get resentful at the group. I make all the pots decaf. I'll get them one way or another. They will pay. Yeah, I wasn't rendered white as snow the day I walked in here, believe me. You know, so how you know, I don't know how they put up with it. But they did, you know, they loved me. And I, oh gosh, Marcia, Martha, I loved her so much. And she loved me enough to, she loved me enough to tell me the truth. She told me the truth. She'd say, you look fat in those pants, go change. You know, you gotta love someone enough to tell them the truth. She wanted me to survive. She wanted me to live. So I had a ball. She talked me into going to night school. She said, you gotta go back to school. You can't make a, you know, I had become a secretary then. I'm at a desk now. I can type like a whiz. I do everything compulsively, right? I could probably type 7,000 minutes, words a minute. You know, coffee, cigarettes. I'm a great secretary. But you don't make any money. She said, you got to go to school. She said, what did you ever want to be? I said, be. I don't remember. So she said, think it over. So I come back, you know, I said, I always wanted to be a nurse. I really did like that job. And I really admired the nurse. But I'm not smart enough, and I'm not pretty enough. She said, oh, is that what they told you when you went down and applied at the nursing school? I was never going to apply. I already know what they're going to say. You know, you're not good enough. You're not good enough. So she says, let's go down there and get the forms. Go get some forms. We're going to fill out some forms. So I went and got them, and she helped me fill them all out. And I got into the nursing school. And I went to the nursing school. I became a registered nurse. I said, yeah, I did. And I stuck. It was amazing to be of service. It was amazing to pay taxes. I was like, what's all this about taxes? I don't like that part. But it was amazing to be of service, to be actually helpful to people when they really needed it. And I did that for about 16 years. I was a sober mother to my son. He had hockey. I was at the hockey rink every freezing cold moment of it. I was there. He had Boy Scouts. He had guitar lessons. We had vacations, family vacations, him and I. The best time of my life. I had about 7 years of sobriety. And I called up Martha. I said, Martha, listen, they don't appreciate me at this job. And I had a good job. They don't give me the days off that I request. And now by then I had bought my own home for my son and I to live in. I mean, unbelievable gifts. He's got his own room. And I call her up and I say, you know, I like this house and everything, but I don't like mowing the lawn. Everyone else has a guy out mowing their lawn. I don't have a guy to mow the lawn. I have to do it. Where's my guy? I've been 7 years sober. She goes, wonder why. But so I'm complaining, you know, I'm going on and on. And then my son, he doesn't clean his room properly. I cleaned it. I took pictures of how it's to look. I hung the pictures. He don't do it. He won't do it. And I'm getting a car. I'm getting a brand new car, first time in my life. And they don't have a blue one. Can you believe that? I gotta wait. The audacity of that Toyota dealership. I have to wait. I mean, from where I come from, this is what I sound like. And she says to me, after I finally stopped long enough to take a breath so she could get a word in, she says, "You know, you're right. Your life sucks. Go in the bathroom and slit your wrists." "And I'll stay on the phone to make sure nobody saves you." "But hurry up, because I got to get to chemo." "Oh, I forgot she had cancer, you know." And I was like, oh my God. I was so embarrassed. I felt this big. I got off of that call. And I was just shocked at myself. Like, what's the matter with me? How could I be like that? I didn't sleep for 3 nights. It took me 3 nights to call her back. I was so embarrassed. I said, "How's your cancer? How's chemo?" I felt like I was such a terrible friend, you know. So she told me about it. And I said, "Martha, what's the matter with me?" She says, "Alcoholism. It's alcoholism. It's not alcoholism. It's alcoholism." And I said, "Well, what would you have me do?" Because that's the words I learned from her. "What would you have me do?" Hardest thing to say, right? But the best thing. She says, "Ernie and Edith need rides to the meetings." I said, "Ernie, the chicken farmer, he smells. Oh, I don't think I can drive him." She says, "He needs rides. He has DUIs, and he needs rides." I said, "Edith, she's still drinking." "Yeah, she is, and we can't have her driving to the meetings drunk. She needs a ride." I said, "Oh, they need a ride tonight?" She goes, "They need a ride every night." And you know, something about that, I understood in this talking with her that I was very ill, that I was going to meetings. I was trying. I was doing what I thought I should be doing, but I don't know how close to a drink I was. So negative. So negative. And where I had been 7 years ago, I couldn't, you know, I got to do whatever she says. Like, I'm scared. Something is really wrong with me. And I started picking up Ernie and Edith every night. Ernie and Edith, bourbon and chicken farm in the car, my brand new car. The new car smell didn't last long. Bourbon and chicken dung. Ernie and Edith. And I'm driving them and driving them and driving them. And we get to this one meeting on a Wednesday night up in Townsend, Massachusetts, and they give out the chips for every month. They give out a 2-month chip, and Edith goes running up and gets that chip. And Ernie starts barking at me. "She don't have 2 months. I know she don't have 2 months. I smell booze on her last night in this car of yours." I'm there, "Just clap, all right? Just clap. It's a plastic chip. I mean, come on. It's a plastic chip. It's not the Nobel Peace Prize." She's trying. When I get to her house, she's out in the driveway with her hat and her purse ready to go. We get to your house, we gotta wait. "Just clap and don't say anything." She's in the right place. Is she not in the right place? She's in the right place. "Just clap. Be happy she's here." So, we get in the car. He couldn't keep quiet. Ernie, a chicken farmer. He says, "Edith, I know you don't have 2 months." She says, I most certainly do. She says, I have a calendar. I mark all the days I drink. I mark all the days I don't. And I have 60 days today. She just missed the part about having them in a row. She didn't catch that part, have them in a row. It's better if, you know, eventually you'll get them in a row. Just get them. Just come along with us. In that car, I was riding with them, and I started to get better, you see. And I've talked about this story before. I've told it many times. And people say it was the service. It was the service you were doing. I said, perhaps you're right. But I think it was the unity. I think it was the unity. Being in the car with my people, Ernie and Edith, our common problem. We're together. We're going together to get the help we need. I really think the unity helped me to get better. In AA. I never left AA. I just checked out. Think about myself all the time, sitting in the meetings. Sitting there thinking about myself. So that was a major lesson for me. I've had a lot of them. I've had a lot of lessons in here, boy. Good ones. Painful ones, too. I did that nursing about 16 years, and I was like, Martha, these 12-hour shifts are rough. You know, that's rough. If you know any nurses or healthcare providers, you got to give them a hug. Give them a hug and a flower or something. I mean, it was hard work. Spiritually, mentally, physically, it's very difficult. You're with people at their most vulnerable times, trying to help them. And I didn't know at the time I have a heart condition. I was born with a heart condition that I never knew I had till I was in my 40s. I mean, that's another thing. I lived. I survived. I mean, it's amazing that I'm still standing. And but I didn't know any of that, and I said, Martha, I'm tired, and I need a desk job again. And I'd like to go to law school. I think I'm smart enough, and I think I'm pretty enough, because I've seen some of them. I'm going to be okay there. And she said, go get the forms. Go get the forms. It's 8 law schools in and around Boston. Go get some forms. We'll fill them out. And I did. And I got in. They got. And then when they accepted me, you know how you feel. You go, what's wrong with them? Why are they taking me? Something's wrong with them. But I went. I went at night for 4 years. It was wonderful. It was such an opportunity. It was so... I would sit there and think, how did I ever go from the bar stool? I'm going to the bar exam. How did this even happen to me? How did this happen? I just keep coming to the meetings. And in law school, nursing school, anything. You go early, you stay a little late. You help clean up. You do what you're told, you do what you're asked. Try to help somebody else. That's all I did. What else do I know? I don't know anything else. Just what you've taught me here. It works everywhere. So I did that. I moved to Florida, to the Gulf of Mexico, 2008. First, I moved to Orlando. My parents were there. They were getting older. My son was grown on his own journey. And I came to Florida. And I was a sober daughter to my parents in their 80s. And, oh, God, that was wonderful. See, I was one of 7 children. You don't get them to yourself much. And now I had them all to myself. And I had a lot of wonderful times with them. And there were things about me from childhood that healed that I didn't even know were broken. See, I wanted all that time and attention from them. always. I just never dared to. The things that I wouldn't dare to ask for or dream of, because it wouldn't be possible. And there I had them both to myself. And we had a wonderful time. And my mother got ill, and I helped my dad take care of her till she passed away. And one day she said to me, she said, "You know what, Diana? I hope when you're as old as I am, that you have somebody like you around to make you feel the way you make me feel. So very special." Those words, they're worth every aching step you gotta take forward in the year. See, it's not all cherry blossoms and lemonade. It's hard. If anyone tells you it's easy to stay sober, get away from them. It's a big commitment of your life. And you got to do the hard steps. You got to do the stuff you don't want to do. You got to talk about the stuff you never wanted to talk about. But the rewards, it's heaven on earth. How I feel inside is heaven on earth. I mean, and my mother, to hear my mother say that to me, somebody that cried herself to sleep over me, there's no words to express my gratitude. And my dad lived till last year. He was 95. He was World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And he was the nicest guy ever. He was an alcoholic. He knew I was an alcoholic before I knew I was an alcoholic. He'd come to the meetings with me to help me get settled in. That's what he told me. He didn't need it. He was John Wayne. My son went on his journey. I actually want to tell you how I met Stanley. He's my love of my life. And we met in 2012 on Christmas Eve at a detox. You know, because it's always right here you're going to meet. But, no, I'm kidding. My dad and I moved over to the beach, Pinellas County, Largo, Florida, after my mom passed away. And I said, you know, you got to get in with your new home group. You got to fit in. You know, you feel so awkward. And, okay, 10 minutes. And so I was doing that. And they said, we need somebody to speak Christmas Eve at the detox. Well, I love speaking at the detox. So I said, I'll go. And so I went, and Stanley was the other speaker. We weren't the patients. We were the speakers carrying the message of AA to the detox on Christmas Eve. Now I ask you, what is more romantic in Alcoholics Anonymous? There's nothing. And he fell in love with me that very night and became quickly my very best friend in life. And we've been running together pretty much ever since. We've had a lot of ups and downs. We've been through a lot. And it's been a beautiful ride. A beautiful ride. Very, very grateful to have him as my running buddy. He says, I got to sit where I can keep my eye on you. Somebody has to. I don't know what he means by that. My son went on his journey, and I was heartbroken for a long time because he had his own story to live and develop. And he was doing things I never did and didn't know how to help. And my sponsor, Barbara, who's here, she has her own experiences with her children and alcoholism, drug addiction. She said to me, Because I said to her, I want to help my son. You know, can I help my son? She says, you can't help him. She says, you help other people's children in AA. And if your son ever wants help and reaches out for it, it's other people's children who will help him. You mind your business. Stay in your lane. It's hard to do. It's hard when it's your son out there or anybody you love, right? And I went to the Al-Anon, of course. Thank God. Thank God for the Al-Anon. And what happened was, my son called me from a treatment center up in Massachusetts a little over 2 years ago. And he says, Mom, I'm in this detox. I don't feel too good. I said, thank you. He says, I don't know. I said, get on. I said, well, because you got to listen for the ask on the advice. You got to listen for the ask. He says, I don't know what to do. I said, well, somebody told me a long time ago, and I was out of answers, and they said, just get on your knees and ask God to help you. I said, I did it, and I didn't even believe in God. And God didn't care if I didn't believe in him. He helped me anyway. And my son called me the next day. He says, Mom, I feel so much better. I did what you said. I feel so much better. And they're offering me a halfway house, and I'm going to take it. He says, it's down in New Bedford. I've never been there before. I'm not going back to my old life. And he celebrated. He called me after he got to the halfway house. This is the best part. He called me a week later. He says, Mom, I found my people. And I knew he was going to be okay. When he told me that, I knew he was going to be okay. And he is a happy, thriving member of Narcotics Anonymous, living his best life. And he's going to the Hawaii State NA Convention this month. I said, Hawaii has never invited me to go there. But he's excited. I mean, I don't know, when I look at my life now and I go, I don't know what to, there's nothing more that I could want or need or ask for, and there's never going to be enough that I can give back. There's never going to be enough that I can give back to this program. I am my own law firm. I have employees. They do all the work. They tell me where to sit and everything. I'm fine with that. They're wonderful. I don't know how this happened to me. All I did was when the gift was offered to me, I received it. I accepted it. When alcoholism was explained to me, I knew I had it. I didn't want to have it because I wanted to drink. But the writing's on the wall. I have this. I didn't want it. And read, you know, the big book, how it explains it so well. I wasn't happy about it. But in a way, I was, because it explained so much. It explained so much about me, and I knew that this is where I belong now. There's only two places I've ever been at ease, and one is a bar stool, and one is an AA meeting. I'm so grateful that you invited me. This is one of the warmest conventions I've ever been to. And if I could give you anything, it would be the way that I feel right now, I would have you feel it. That's what I would give you. I just hope you have as much fun here this weekend as I've had, and that you love Alcoholics Anonymous as much as I do. And I thank you.